From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the chilling case of Christopher Paul Hassan, the Coast Guard lieutenant accused of plotting to kill Democratic politicians and CNN and MSNBC personalities, is moving into a federal court in Greenbelt, Maryland at this hour. Hassan is the self-described white nationalist who was arrested last Friday after officials found a stockpile of weapons and drugs at his home in Silver Spring, Maryland. Prosecutors say his possession charges today are just the tip of the iceberg. They say he's a domestic terrorist who studied the manifesto of Norway's worst mass killer and wanted to, quote, murder innocent civilians on a scale rarely seen in this country. NPR's national security correspondent Greg Myrie is at the courthouse. Greg, do we know why officials were even on Hassan's trail?
Not entirely clear, but we know the Coast Guard started the investigation. So apparently they got a little bit of a tip. And the evidence that's in this court filing points to the weapons in his house and a lots of emails and letters that he drafted and apparently just kept to himself, where he talked about this desire to kill a lot of people or this list of potential targets. So somehow that drew the Coast Guard into the case. The FBI picked him up in the garage at Coast Guard headquarters last Friday.
And we know about that arrest because of the program of extremism at George Washington University. They track these things. Do we know why officials did not announce it publicly? It's been a week, almost a week.
Yeah, we don't know. What we do know is Seamus Hughes, who works at this program on extremism at George Washington University, follows court filings very, very closely. Mm-hmm. And so the filing was made on Tuesday, but nobody in the media was picking up on it. He found it on Wednesday, tweeted it out, and that's what alerted everybody to this case.
Yes, and remind us about Norway's Anders Behring Breivik, who killed 77 people, mostly children, in that horrific mass attack in Norway in 2011. He wrote a manifesto telling others how to do the same thing, and others we know read it, the shooter at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, and allegedly now Hassan.
Right. Again, the court filing says he did study this manifesto, which goes on for hundreds and hundreds of pages, and it was sort of white nationalist ideology or thinking. In the Norway case, there was a concern more Muslims were coming into the country, and then this horrific shooting where more than 70 people were mm-hmm. killed, and actually two attacks that he carried out back 8 years ago now.
So we have that detail. We have some of the information, again, from the court filings in the emails that the investigators found. In one, in June of 2017, he wrote, "I'm dreaming of a way to kill every last person on earth." He also made other references. Did you just have some of them at your fingertips?
So he had all of these emails or letters that he drafted and seemed to just be keeping to himself, but he did have a spreadsheet, and that's been released, and it has more than 20 names on it. Many of them are Democratic leaders, but it's pretty clear who he's referring to. Pelosi being House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Minority Leader. We also see Poca Warren, which mm-hmm. would appear to be the Pocahontas reference that President Trump has made to Senator Elizabeth Warren. And then, of course, a number of cable TV news anchors from CNN and MSNBC. Some of them, they all seem to be in the evening. Don Lemon and Chris Cuomo, Chris Hayes and Ari Melber. So it seems that he would be watching these guys in the evening and working himself up into a lather based mm-hmm. on this spreadsheet that's mm-hmm. been released.
Yeah. Is there any sense, any indication he was acting with anyone else, or are they concluding he was acting alone?
At this stage, there's no evidence that we're seeing pointing to any other connection, but he does reference these other events, as we mentioned, the Norwegian shooting or the Charlottesville case a couple years ago. So he's aware of these things. He's mentioning them. He's talking about the need for action, but there's no indication that he's linked to any particular group. He does mention that he's been a skinhead for 30 years or more. And again, he's had a military affiliation for 30 years or more. He was in the Marines and the Army National Guard dating back to the 80s and 90s and has been in the Coast Guard at their headquarters in Washington for the past 3 years.
And just all these details are disturbing, but one is that he apparently had also stockpiled medications and what seemed like hormones or something, again, on the direction of the Norway killer, painkillers because killing people was going to be perhaps muscular work, but also some kind of bodybuilding supplement.
Yes, he had, according to the prosecutors, he had a large amount of steroids in his house and tramadol, very powerful and addictive narcotic. And there seemed to be a reference in some of his writings that he needed this to build himself up, to make him stronger for what he planned to do. And we didn't have a date or some sort of fixed schedule about what he might try to do. But again, it seems a part of the same package, the weapons, the steroids, the drugs.
NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Murray, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, voters in Nigeria, perhaps more than 80 million of them, will head to the polls Saturday for a presidential election that was originally scheduled for last weekend. That vote was postponed just a few hours before polls were scheduled to open, apparently because essential voting materials hadn't been delivered due to violence and bad weather. Joining us now is BBC Nigeria correspondent Mayeni Jones. She's in the capital, Abuja. Mayeni, does it look like this week's election will go ahead as planned?
Well, they've given every assurance. The Electoral Commission has been briefing electoral observers and members of the public every day. They say that they are confident that the election will be able to take place on the new date of Saturday the 23rd. But we have to remember that they gave similar assurances about a week ago when, there were claims around the country that ballot papers hadn't arrived in various polling stations. At the time, they said, we're 100% confident we can make it happen. And as a matter of fact, the head of the Electoral Commission said the reason why they waited so long to postpone the election is because they were still confident up to the very last minute, 2 o'clock on Saturday morning last week. They were still confident they would be able to make it. So they say there won't be another postponement, but people aren't holding their breath.
There are 73 registered presidential candidates in this election, but who are the real contenders and what message are they using to try to win?
Yeah, so the two main contenders are the incumbent, President Muhammadu Buhari of the All Progressives Congress, APC, and the main opposition contestant is Atiku Abubakar. He's a former vice president. He was vice president from 1999 to 2007, and he represents the People's Democratic Party, the PDP. There's very little to differentiate the two men. Traditionally in Nigeria, you've had one presidential candidate from the north of the country, which is predominantly Muslim, and one from the south, which is majority Christian. But this time, both men are from the north of the country. Both are Muslim, both are from the same ethnic group, and both are in their 70s. So in terms of the profile of the candidates, they're very similar. In terms of policy offerings, President Buhari is a former military ruler in Nigeria, and he very much believes in the big states, so that the state has the answers to many of the countries' problems, including the economy. He believes more state intervention is needed to beef up Nigeria's economy, which has been suffering from the fall in the price of oil. Whereas Mr. Abubakar is a very prominent, very successful businessman. So he thinks the solution to the country's economic problems lies with the private sector. He wants to privatize the state oil company, and he wants to invite more private sector actors to be involved in the country's economy.
Now, Nigeria is currently the seventh most populous country on earth, and the projections from the United Nations say that it's going to surpass the United States and become the third most populous by 2050. This is a very big and fast-growing country. What is at stake right now and in Nigeria in general with this election?
Well, obviously, you can imagine that a population that's growing at such a pace creates a number of problems for any government in charge. So the economy, as I mentioned, is a big problem. Unemployment, particularly amongst young people, is a huge problem. Nigeria's population is quite young. The majority of it is under the age of 35. So whoever is voted in this coming Saturday will have to find a way of bolstering the economy, of creating jobs for this young and restless population. And then there's also the issue of security. I talked earlier about a conflict in the northeast of the country between Islamist militants and the government, but there's also been clashes between herders and farmers in the middle of the country. They've been competing for land. Nigeria's oil fields in the south of the country have been targeted by militants, and we've seen a flare-up of violence in the northwest of the country where bandits and cattle rustlers have been attacking civilians and taking their money and causing a lot of violence up there. So security is another big issue, as well as the economy, and these are going to be some of the challenges that the president, whoever rules Nigeria over the next 4 years, is going to have to contend with.
Are there any outside influences on this election, or other countries trying to get involved and make sure that one side or the other wins?
Well, because Nigeria is such a big country and it's Africa's largest economy, many international actors are interested in the elections going smoothly with as little violence as possible. Any conflict that flares up in Nigeria has the potential to destabilize the wider region. So there's been, you know, several electoral missions here, including from the UK, the US and the European Union and the African Union. And there have been accusations on the parts of local politicians that some of these foreign actors may be interfering with the process. They sent out several warnings saying, you know, encouraging foreign powers not to interfere in Nigeria's elections. But as far as we've seen, there's no evidence of this. The observer missions all say that they're merely here to make sure that the process goes smoothly and to kind of write reports about what's happened, but they're not here to dictate how it turns out in the end.
That is the BBC's Nigeria correspondent, Mayeni Jones, joining us from Abuja. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And again, the election scheduled for Saturday.
And a cautionary note now for parents. We're following news that Nestle, Disney, and other companies have pulled or postponed ad campaigns on Google-owned YouTube after reports that a pedophile network worked its way into the comment sections of videos of young girls doing things like yoga or gymnastics. Sometimes the ads were on the same page as the comments. A spokesperson for Nestle says YouTube's parent company, Google, has reassured them it's taking action, and YouTube updated its content policy on Tuesday, so we will keep an eye on that. But staying with information useful to parents, there's been a big change in scouting. The Boy Scouts of America opened up its flagship program to girls this month, breaking with more than 100 years of tradition, renaming its most well-known program Scouts BSA. Ximena Kandi from member station WHYY followed an all-girl troop from Chester County, Pennsylvania, on their second day in the program.
It's Lily Rohner's first time at the Klondike Derby. The Derby takes a page out of the Klondike Gold Rush. Scouts push a sled filled with gear through the snow around the Horseshoe Scout Reservation in Peach Bottom, Pennsylvania. At different stations, they build a campfire or practice first aid, racking up points. Lily and her all-girl, Troop 19, is one of the first in Scouts BSA. While the overall program is co-ed, all troops are single-sex. Troop 19 is also the only all-girl troop at the Derby. That's a dozen girls in a sea of more than 100 boys. But that doesn't matter to Lily, who's about to turn 11 and pumped for the day outdoors.
It just pulls me in because I've never really considered myself, like, too much of, like, one of those girly girl type of things, like paint my nails, do my hair, have long hair.
Still, Troop 19 is only on its second day of scouting. They're still catching up on skills like archery, fire building,
3, 2, 1.
And axe throwing.
Nice.
That's 5 points.
Mia Christensen is happy to be there, even if the troop doesn't win any events. She says Scouts BSA is different than other activities open to girls.
They actually like teach you leadership and wilderness survival, and they just teach you like things that I feel like you'll actually need in life.
And Mia has looked elsewhere for these opportunities. She's been a Girl Scout since kindergarten and plans to stay. But she says she's not challenged in Girl Scouts. The awards she earns in Girl Scouts, such as Social Butterfly, help them practice manners and social skills, and don't excite her.
I mean, it's good, but, like, it's not going to really, like, be life-changing.
Still, the Girl Scouts do have badges that award learning about things like first aid and robot programming. Kim Freitas-Dow is the CEO of the Girl Scouts of Eastern Pennsylvania.
Caving, rock climbing, kayaking, canoeing, hatchet throwing, you name it, we offer it at Girl Scouts. So there really is something for all girls to do pretty much every weekend of the year, including at summer camp.
She says girls can find what they like and don't like in all-girl settings. Last year, the Girl Scouts of the USA sued the Boy Scouts of America over its decision to rename its flagship program. The quarrel comes after decades of overall membership decline in both organizations. But all that feels far away at the Derby.
Go, Josie! Go, Josie! Come on,
Josie! Josie Provencher is 11, at least a head shorter than most of the girls her age. She's so excited about the Derby, she wore her full Class A uniform, a khaki shirt, and dark green pants. Most kids wore jeans or casual bottoms. Josie is shy in large groups, but a standout performer at the Derby, surprising her peers when she volunteered to represent them in multiple events.
I'm gonna get, like, at least 60.
There you go. That's the attitude.
Josie's Scoutmaster, Melissa Pendle, says giving girls access to these opportunities to grow is why she volunteered to lead the troop.
Maybe it's their age, that they're kind of on the edge of being shy and being more self-confident. And I think it doesn't take a lot to push them from one side to the other.
And scouts like 11-year-old Ethan Taylor don't mind the presence of girls at the Derby.
I don't really care because, number one, we're one of the last countries to let boys and girls cooperate and, like, scouting and all that.
A majority of the member countries in the World Organization of the Scout Movement allow boys and girls in their programs. And Tom Murphy, a ranger at the reservation for 9 years, says these international girl and boy troops coexist just fine. He welcomes Troop 19.
I didn't think this would ever happen. I thought it was going to be a male-dominated program as long as I ever lived, but I think it's times are changing.
Murphy says he looks forward to the day when a girl from Troop 19 earns the highest rank in Scouts BSA, Eagle Scout. Mia Christensen says she hopes to earn her Eagle before her older brother does. For Here Now, I'm Ximena Condi.
Okay, switching gears. So you say your vegetables seem a little meh. How about taking Here Now resident chef Kathy Gunn's suggestion and roasting them? She joins us in the studio. Kathy, tell us more.
So it's that time of year when things aren't looking particularly sexy. You go to the store.
You mean vegetables.
Specifically vegetables, Robin. Let's focus here. You know, there are those root vegetables that have been sitting in somebody's root cellar for a few months. But you can bring them to life by roasting them. And I'm going to take you through a few unusual dishes. The first one is a radicchio salad. Now, radicchio is an Italian chicory. It's in the chicory family. It's in season now through April. I brought you a raw radicchio because that is, I think, one of the most stunning vegetables you'll find this winter. It's maroon and white. Mm-hmm. This is a Verona, which is a roundish one. There's also a radicchio called Treviso. You can use either one, but it's these purple leaves and white ribs, and it looks like an Italian still life, doesn't it? Mm. Now, the characteristic of radicchio is bitterness, which for a lot of people, they're like, why would I want to eat something bitter?
But it's so fresh.
Right? That raw radicchio. And you can get that all winter. And this is a bitterness that's pleasing. Mm-hmm. When you roast the radicchio at like 475, it burns on the edges and it gets subtler and sweeter, but it does still maintain the bitterness. So what I do is I have these beautiful, almost burnt radicchio wedges, and I put them on top of an herbed ricotta mixture.
Oh boy.
So you have creamy with some fresh herbs. Then I drizzle it with honey. So you have bitter and sweet and creamy. Grate a little lemon zest. And then I toasted hazelnuts, which are meaty and crunchy, and they add texture and color. This is my number one absolute favorite winter salad right now.
This is amazing.
I just love it.
The bitterness, I mean, there's a substance to it. There's a depth to it, but that bitterness is gone.
Yeah, exactly. And then the honey offsets it. And then those crunchy, meaty hazelnuts kind of make anything taste better.
Wonderful.
So I love that. Now, the second dish I brought is kind of a take on the same idea, but quite different. I roasted a cabbage. Now, we've talked about cabbage before. These are small wedges. Again, high temperature. What happens to the cabbage is it loses that kind of raw bite that you find in coleslaw that many people find disagreeable. And it also sweetens and mellows. And I serve this very wonderful roasted cabbage with a chive mustard caper vinaigrette. So the saltiness of the capers, that little bit of creamy mustard, the fresh green flecks of the chive, you won't feel like it's the middle of winter and you're suffering in any way, shape, or form.
This is not, and God bless them, but this isn't your grandmother's cabbage. You know, I used to go to my grandmother's apartment building and you smelled
it before
cabbage.
You got out of your car. Absolutely.
Right.
This is definitely not.
Yeah.
However, I bet your grandmother would love it.
Yeah. Delicious. So those are two unique dishes. We'll have the recipes at herenow.org. But just when things start to turn in the drawer, what's the best way to just get the best out of them?
You know, the thing is that the root vegetables last for quite a while. So let's say you have some carrots, or you have parsnips, or Brussels sprouts, or baby turnips. You can take these, brush them with olive oil, good sea salt, and pepper, and roast them. So that part, sure, you understand that. But then what do you do? I would like to suggest that you think of it almost like a pizza, where you're going to use that as the base, let's call it the dough, and you're going to put different toppings on. So you could start by thinking about interesting spices. What if you roasted it with some cinnamon or cumin or za'atar? What if you added spicy harissa? What if you topped it with a dollop of yogurt or crumbled feta cheese? Mm. In other words, we're building flavors here. Crunchy pumpkin seeds on top of roasted broccoli or broccolini or cauliflower. Fresh sage leaves on top of roasted butternut or winter squash wedges. Basically, you're taking your simple roast vegetable recipe and you're adding colors and textures and flavors, because in the winter, we crave this so much. Our plates tend to look blah, as you said. Yeah. So anything with color, the white of feta cheese sprinkled on top of roasted carrots, a drizzle of maple syrup to bring out the natural sugars in these vegetables, you know, a sprinkle of fresh chopped basil, which you can find all winter long, grated lemon zest or lime zest. Suddenly, these vegetables that are just sitting there saying, hello, do something with me, become lively and almost spring-like.
What vegetables? Are there any two you wouldn't put together in a roast?
The only problem is vegetables that cook at different temperatures. Essentially, you can put anything together that appeals to you, but if you are roasting, let's say, a carrot, which is dense, it's going to take a lot longer than a tiny little Brussels sprout. So you just test it and you take out whatever's done ahead of time. But no, there's no rhyme or reason to this. There's no way that you're going to go wrong with this. That burnt radicchio salad sort of transcends winter and the idea of just limited possibilities.
It is so good.
I'm so glad you like it.
It could be an hors d'oeuvre. You know, people could pick it with their hands. It could be a dessert.
Absolutely. I'm with you. Yes.
So good. So, well, just fantastic as always and so easy. Thank you, Kathy Guns.
And they can be made ahead.
Great. We'll have all the recipes at herenow.org. Kathy, as usual, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
And with apologies for the eating sounds, I'm sorry.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
Johnson & Johnson was subpoenaed this week over questions related to the talc in its flagship baby powder and whether that talc could contain asbestos, which is known to cause cancer. The subpoenas from the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Department of Justice come on the heels of an investigation by Reuters that found the company knew about the asbestos risk and failed to disclose it for years. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Jeremy.
And first of all, just tell us what this Reuters report found, the one that is at the heart of this.
Well, the bombshell news then was that J&J knew and hid from regulators and consumers that you could find trace amounts of asbestos in its signature baby powder. I mean, you mentioned asbestos and potential cover-up, and investors were immediately scared of the lawsuit implications and chopped something like $40 to $50 billion of value off of J&J in just a few days.
And when you look at what the talc maybe did to people who were exposed to it, just last year, 22 women sued Johnson & Johnson and won $4.7 billion in damages, saying that the baby powder that they used caused their ovarian cancer. They won that suit. Does that mean that the evidence is clear on this?
Not necessarily. It means that there is officially chum in the water for more and more lawsuits. And that's an overhang that no consumer goods company ever wants. You look at asbestos liability, it's bankrupted so many firms. J&J is appealing this and the studies have been contradictory. But news like today's follow-on news is only going to encourage trial attorneys.
The irony of this is hard to miss for a company that has branded itself on the idea of trust. I want to listen here to one of their ads. Listen.
Minutes old. A baby's skin is never more delicate. What do hospitals use to wash and protect it? Johnson's, the number one choice of hospitals.
So how problematic, therefore, are these revelations for a company that obviously, as you can hear in that ad, need to be trusted by people who want to, you know, use their products on newborn babies?
Right. I mean, even though baby products are only about $2 billion of a $77 billion portfolio for J&J, it's valued by the stock market at $360 billion. You have to put it in context. But baby products like this powder and, you know, J&J Tearless Shampoo, they're the calling cards of a company that doesn't always put its name on its bestsellers. But look, J&J is resilient. Its handling of the Tylenol poisonings, for example, in 1982, made it, you know, a B-school case study in crisis management.
What should consumers do on this particular issue? The Reuters report was focused on the time period between 1971 and the early 2000s, but should people be tossing their baby powder out today just to be safe?
I mean, mothers share notes, and the market for organic or just barely chemically derived alternatives to these products, it's already booming with or without J&J. And I know anecdotally of parents who will only buy cornstarch-based baby powders or shampoos free of controversial components that J&J still uses. So the market, I think, is ultimately going to force this company's hands.
That is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, on the news about Johnson & Johnson, which was subpoenaed this week over questions about the talc in its baby powder. Robin, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
All week, we've been looking at places around the country that are successfully reducing homelessness. And they have one thing in common, a model called Housing First, where, as Martha Cagle in New Orleans told us,
you just accept them as they are and you provide the housing first. Then once they're in their apartment, you immediately wrap all the services around them that they need to stay stable.
Well, in Chicago, hospitals have joined the effort. The University of Illinois Hospital is one of a few that have started providing permanent housing for homeless patients that repeatedly show up in emergency rooms. They treat chronic homelessness as a health issue, and it appears to be working. Between November 2015, when the program began, and June 2017, the hospital saw a 21% decrease in the average monthly healthcare costs of the first patients it housed. Joining us now is Stephen Brown, who's the Director of Preventive Emergency Medicine at the University of Illinois Hospital in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you.
And explain, first of all, what exactly you did there in Chicago that seemed to work.
So we created something called a Better Health Through Housing program. We partnered with the Center for Housing and Health, it's a subsidiary of the AIDS Foundation. They were looking to replicate some of the outcomes from a randomized control trial here that was done in the early 2000s that demonstrated the efficacy of what we call housing first. We identified chronically homeless individuals, those that are homeless continuously for over a year or who have had four episodes in the previous 3 years, and then transition them into permanent supportive housing. And then we tracked their mortality, their morbidity, and their cost and utilization.
And these people were coming into the hospital quite frequently.
Yeah, you know, they're called by a variety of monikers, frequent flyers, frequent visitors. Super utilizers is kind of the du jour title now.
And so the idea is just get them into some kind of housing and then they won't be coming into the hospital as frequently.
That's correct. Yes.
How do you do that exactly? Why would you at the hospital be the one who has to figure out, let's put this person into housing?
That's a great question. So when we started doing this, we were kind of in the blind and found our way around this. I think we didn't really have a strong justification to doing this other than it was part of our health equity mission and it was the right thing to do. But kind of backing into it after having gone through this experience, I think we've got a lot of compelling data that says that – essentially says that housing is health. That once you put someone into stable housing with a little bit of support or more support depending on the severity of their mental illness or substance abuse, they tend to do well. And that means that they stop coming to emergency departments. So they often come for non-medical reasons. We call it secondary gain. So if someone is living unsheltered under a bridge and they have no other options because they might have been kicked out of crisis shelters, they're going to come to our emergency department and seek care. So we've now got some pretty compelling data that the solution may be cheaper than the problem.
Hmm. And how much is the solution? How much does that end up costing to find housing for these people?
So for us, we pay $1,000 per member per month, a maximum of $12,000 a year. That's put together with a number of other subsidies that the Center for Housing and Health has with HUD and other grantors. If you were to look at the total cost of housing and support for an individual that would be in a housing first model, it's about fully loaded about $25,000 a year. Now, if you contrast that with some of the health, just the healthcare costs, and only my healthcare costs, I'm not able to look at Medicaid claims data. We had patients that had healthcare costs that's somewhere between 2.5 to 160 times our average patient cost. One gentleman who was deceased before I ever met him had a reimbursable cost from the state of $938,000. We often joke it's probably cheaper to put him up in a hotel in, on North Michigan at $625 a night. An ER visit's about $1,200.
But they're still going to have whatever health issues, right, that they would have come in for in the first place, or are they simply coming in to get shelter?
It's a combination of both. Being homeless is hard on the body. You're prone to injury and violence, to frostbite. And if you have a chronic medical condition, it's only going to exacerbate it. So we found very high rates of chronic disease. We also found some individuals that were just coming for what we call secondary gain, and their health care costs plummeted because they had no reason to seek out shelter in the emergency departments any longer. But most of them are pretty sick.
How is the program funded?
So we did this originally through a gifting account through some philanthropic dollars in our first fiscal year. The hospital is now committed through fiscal year 2023 through our operating budget. I must say, though, you know, what we're doing is not sustainable because we're not being paid for it. Mm-hmm. But there's a much larger effort going on in Chicago through what we call the flexible housing pool that's going to make this sustainable. And we're attracting a number of insurance companies that are looking at some of the data that we're saying, and we're making a really compelling economic argument to insurance companies that it's worth the investment in housing. So there are several managed care organizations that manage Medicaid patients here that are very interested in some of the data that we have.
Well, just to be clear, if things were to go on as they were and people would come in and, you know, spend $100,000 or $900,000 on hospital bills, who's paying for that?
Ultimately, the state, because we're a Medicaid expansion state. If this were a non-Medicaid expansion state, it would be in the best economic interest of the hospital to pay for the housing of these individuals because they're losing money on these individuals. In the state of Illinois, about 85% of the homeless have some form of insurance. And we don't have the results yet. We'll have it in a month, but we're running it on this 1,200 patients that we know to be homeless. We're doing a profit and loss statement to the hospital, which I think it would be very interesting for other hospitals to look at once we're completed with the study.
What are the big challenges that remain from your point of view of how to deal with homelessness generally?
So when you start with homelessness, the thing about it is it's uber complex. It's just not about healthcare. These individuals have had significant engagement with the criminal justice system. They get picked up by EMS for chronic inebriation, or they're in psychiatric crisis. They're brought to our emergency department. Police and fire bring them up. And whenever I talk to anybody in all these different public sectors, everybody says the same things. Your people are my people. The intersectionality of these people are extraordinary. And so there are extraordinary conversations going across the city with real estate developers, banking and finance that want to be able to give us the sustainable financing we need to create permanent supportive housing for these individuals. We're talking with people in the jail. It turns out the lack of housing is a huge source of the recidivism rate here in the state of Illinois, which is about 44% after 2 years. So it's an uber complex thing, and you just keep peeling back the onion, you find more and more. The good news is that we all kind of went from working in our silos and being very narrow in our thinking now to it's much more expansive, and people are much willing to have more collaborative conversations. And I think we're going to see some great outcomes here this year with the launch of the flexible housing pool. The other thing I should mention about the pool is once fully funded, and that's about $12 million, and if there's any corporations out there that would like to help us, give me a call. But once fully funded, it actually builds capacity. So that will create 750 new affordable housing units here in the city of Chicago. So every hospital that contributes to the pool is not only serving their narrow interests, but also the greater good. This idea of collective impact is really resonating here in Chicago.
Do you see this happening in other cities, or do you think that this model would work in other cities?
I think it will. You know, the good thing about Chicago, well, bad thing, is it's uber complex and it's big, and there's a political layer to it. But everybody's moving in the right direction. When I started this program, I was looking longingly at some mid-level cities like McLean County in Illinois, Indianapolis. They're doing great things there. But we're now sharing models across the country. L.A. County, L.A. City are doing some amazing things. In fact, we're replicating the flexible housing pool. That was their model that we're standing up here.
Hmm. What would be your number one piece of advice to other cities right now as they try to tackle homelessness?
Can't do it by yourself. It's you got to get everybody. Everybody's got to work together. It takes a particular kind of mindset to do this, and it's uber complicated, and it requires trust and patience among all the different stakeholders.
That is Stephen Brown, who is director of preventive emergency medicine at the University of Illinois Hospital in Chicago, which is treating chronic homelessness as a health issue. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll wrap up our series tomorrow with a look at how Atlanta has reduced homelessness by 30% in the past 3 years and how the city is trying to innovate ways to help homeless LGBTQ young adults. You can find our entire series at hereandnow.org. And a program note, since we were just talking about Chicago, I will be broadcasting from WBEZ in Chicago next Wednesday and Thursday. Lots to cover, including the mayor's race. Be sure to tune in.
In 2006, Vermont's Next Generation Commission was asked to develop a plan to keep Vermonters living and working in the state, citing critical demographic shifts, and then things went downhill. Since 1997, the state schools have lost 30,000 kids. Businesses say there's a critical shortage of skilled labor. As Vermont Governor Phil Scott said recently, we don't need new taxes, we need new taxpayers. So, a year ago, the state's Department of Tourism and Marketing launched a pilot program, the Stay-to-Stay Weekend, in which participants travel to different resorts on different weekends to network about jobs and homes and schools. This winter, they've added a twist, the Stay-to-Stay Ski Weekend. Wendy Knight is commissioner of the Vermont Department of Tourism and Marketing. She joins us from Vermont Public Radio in Colchester. And Wendy, these Stay-to-Stay Weekends, people pay their way, but then you do what? Tell us about the Stay-to-Stay Ski Weekend, for instance.
Sure. So the skiing is something new that we added this weekend. One at Killington, one at Mount Snow, and one at Bromley.
What happens for the people who come?
So they'll ski or ride on Saturday, and then they can join a reception on Saturday evening with locals from the community, as well as other people that are interested in moving to Vermont to find out what are the opportunities for living and working in Vermont.
So they have entrepreneurs, people who have companies, potential employers, and real estate agents?
Yeah, so the welcome reception is designed to connect people who are interested in moving to Vermont to those in the community that can help them relocate. Mm-hmm. So that could be school superintendents, neighbors, people that have recently moved to Vermont, as well as community leaders and business owners.
This is so cool. First of all, I have cousins in Vermont. I can just see my cousin Peggy. She would arrive with a basket of baked goods.
That's the idea, is to welcome people, is to be gracious and to welcome people and to have that support network.
How many people come?
Well, last year we had 4 pilot weekends throughout the year, and we had 140 guests that came. Of those 140, we have had 8 people who have actually moved here already. We have an additional 35 people who are actively job hunting or looking for a house and planning to move here within the next year.
Let's bring in Nicole Smith, a graduate of the Stay to Stay program, came up for a weekend and then did relocate to Vermont from Denver, Colorado. Now lives there in Arlington, Vermont. Nicole, I'm thinking Colorado to Vermont. Some people would say that's not such a big switch, but for you, what was it?
I have a lot of family back in New York, so I had been in Denver for about 4 years, and I had wanted to relocate to an area closer to home, but had fallen in love with the mountains of Colorado. And this Stay-to-Stay program came up when I was researching different towns. And what really attracted me to the Stay-to-Stay program was that they were providing us with networking opportunities. Like the first thing that I was introduced to was the Chamber of Commerce of the town Bennington, Vermont, which I chose as my Stay-to-Stay weekend. And so all of a sudden, this big, scary move for me was kind of much more approachable. Yeah. And I literally met business owners, I met realtors, I met people from the banks, I met so many people that I would have never been able to have the opportunity to meet, and it just all of a sudden gave me like a community feel, which I immediately fell in love with.
Here you are. All these people are gathered. It's like a welcome wagon It must have made it so much easier. Is that how you got a job, by the way? How did you, you're running a daycare.
So we went out to dinner with the Chamber of Commerce and some other business owners. And I applied to four different jobs that weekend. And we also applied for the apartment that we are now living in that weekend as well.
Do you think you would have been able to do this quickly and efficiently without that?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
This big scary move that I was like looking up Craigslist ads for jobs, Zillow apartments, and then all of a sudden within a weekend, we had gone to the Status Day weekend on August 10th, and September 1st we moved to Vermont.
Wow. Wendy Knight, again, of the Vermont Department of Tourism. You have a great spokesperson there in Nicole Smith. But
absolutely.
So you say she's one of eight people who've, you know, actually physically made this move and is putting down roots, which is great, but wow, is that going to be enough to help Vermont's problem or to justify the effort you're putting into this?
Well, the effort is nominal in terms of cost. So as you said in the beginning of your segment, the governor has made it very clear that expanding our workforce and growing our economy is one of his top priorities. So the goal of the state-to-state program is very singular. We want to grow our workforce and increase our tax base. And one of the ways we do that is by encouraging more people like Nicole to live and work in Vermont.
Yeah.
There really is no downside. Mm. I always talk about the one state-to-state weekend reception I went to in Rutland, and we had seven guests that came that weekend, and we had 60 people from the community that came out. And some people think that that's over the top, but I don't know how you can find fault with being gracious and welcoming.
Yeah. Well, it sounds great. Nicole Smith, again, who went to the Stay and Stay weekend in Vermont and relocated to Vermont from Denver, Colorado. Nicole, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And Wendy Knight, Commissioner of the Vermont Department of Tourism and Marketing. We're going to link people up to your Stay to Stay and Stay to Stay and Ski programs at hereandnow.org. Wendy, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And we'll also link you to Vermont's program that pays expenses for people to move to the state but work remotely in another. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.